Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our guest is the awesome Michelle Hansen, founder of GeoCodio, co-founder of GeoCodio. And the author of Deploy Empathy, and we're going to talk about customer development today. This show is brought to you by UserList, the best tool for sending onboarding emails and segmenting your SaaS users. To follow the best practices, download our free printable email planning worksheets at userlist.com/worksheets. Hey, Michelle.
Hey, Jane. Thank you so much for having me on.
We are delighted. Congrats on your book launch last year. That's a smashing success. So for those listeners who don't know you, tell us what you do and what's your background story.
Yeah, so I am co-founder of GeoCodio, as you mentioned. We are a geocoding and data matching SaaS focused on North America. Co-founded that company with my husband as a side project in 2014. I was working as a product manager at the time. And I was technically a technical project manager when we launched, but then I became a full-time product manager shortly after. And so then I went full-time on that in 2017. I'm also the co-host of Software Social Podcast, which is a podcast I co-host with Colleen Schnettler, who recently started her own small SaaS. So it's kind of a combination of someone with a mature SaaS and someone just getting one started. And then I also wrote a book last year called Deploy Empathy about doing customer interviews, because that customer development was really one of my focus areas as a product manager. And I found that when I transitioned to being an entrepreneur, other entrepreneurs had a lot of questions about how to understand their customers and how to talk to them, and never mind how to interview them. And I found that I was having the same phone call and email threads over and over and over again. And I really didn't have like one solid resource to send people. It was like a jumble of resources. And so I started writing the book as a newsletter last February, wrote it in public, and then published it in July of last year.
Little Bird says that the sales have been well, right?
Yes. It sold over 1,000 copies, was number one on Product Hunt. It's just had an incredible reaction from the community. And I'm so grateful and honestly still surprised that people are so excited about interviewing their customers.
I'm curious, there is sort of a go-to book that exists in our ecosystem about interviewing your customer, your potential customers, and that would be the Mom Test that we always keep recommending. And I know your book has a slightly different angle. And what is the difference between the Mom Test that you do cover and that doesn't?
Yeah, I think the Mom Test does such a great job of, you know, really like introducing many people who are not from a UX or product background to the idea of talking to users, you know, talking to potential users and validating ideas with them, and not just saying, you know, is this a good idea, but really trying to understand what they're trying to do and building for that. So it's so great for that pre-launch phase. And in many ways, the ideal reader of my book is someone who has read the Mom Test. But customer interviewing and understanding your customers is useful throughout the whole company lifecycle, from before you launch to figuring out which features to build, figuring out why somebody bought so you can find more people like them who will buy, or figuring out why someone canceled, figuring out why people aren't converting. All of these problems and so many more can be solved by understanding customers better and by interviewing them. And having that as part of your toolbox throughout the whole company lifecycle is incredibly helpful. And so my book focuses on having tactics and scripts for talking to people throughout all of these common situations that people can build off of. And so the Mom Test is a fantastic book. I recommend it in my book. But in many ways, this is sort of like the sort of intermediate level of interviewing customers, you know, for people who've sort of already been introduced to the idea.
Before we go into what actually happens during the interviews, one of the biggest challenges, like, you don't need to sell any SaaS founders and why it's important to talk to their customers. And it's also like, when you have a specific use case, you probably would do that. But I always have trouble figuring out who to talk to. And most importantly, how to get that on that call. Because just writing that, you know, we need to talk to you about something, it's not motivating enough, while offering a material incentive is also kind of sleazy. What is the best way based on your practice?
Yeah, I talk about this in my book. Spend a lot of time talking about how to recruit people and when you should offer incentives and when you shouldn't, because it is tricky, and getting people to reply and getting them on the phone and getting them just like, those things can be really challenging. So I think it really depends on the problem that you're looking to solve. It's probably the easiest if you're looking at, like, let's say, for example, you notice that customers are having issues with a particular feature or page of your product. When somebody reaches out to support with that problem, you know, you solve that problem for them. And then maybe a week later, see like, hey, last week you reached out to us because you were having issues with the billing section on our dashboard. We're currently looking at ways to improve this and make this easier for people. Do you have 30 minutes to hop on a call? And so I can see how you use that. And I find that people are much more likely to reply to that when you're saying, hey, you had this specific problem. You had this interest in this thing. And we're coming to you because we think you have something valuable to say about it. And it's not cold, right? It's very warm because you're showing interest in their experience, and people really appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, it's really also about, you know, targeting to the right people. And, you know, I find that with somebody who's canceled or someone who's not a customer, you know, an incentive is really, really important to getting them on the phone. But with someone who is a current customer, they might feel weird that you're offering them, you know, a gift card, and instead, you know, really appreciate a pair of company branded socks or simply a nice handwritten thank you note from the founder goes, or the person who talked to them, like, goes a really, really long way. And just the ability to influence your roadmap is a huge incentive on its own. So it really depends on the situation. And so in the book, I kind of break it down of like, here's kind of how you can think about it. And here's some situations where you're going to want to use an incentive. Here's ones where I don't recommend it. And here's how you can reach out to people through email, through Reddit. Here's templates you can use to, you know, send those out. But I mean, even my emails, I'm constantly A/B testing my new user feedback emails. And I think the highest I've ever gotten that response rate is 8%. You know, I don't really have time to, you know, fill my calendar with interviews either, you know, so as long as I'm doing a couple a week, then that's, you know, you don't need 100% of people to reply.
That's a good angle to think about.
You have other things to do, right? Like
those incentives, do you offer them when you are trying to book people, or do you offer that as a thank you on the call or afterwards?
So if I'm offering a like cash incentive, so for example, what I often do is a $25 gift card to Amazon. But what I think of that as is basically a gift card that is the equivalent amount of money for a nice lunch to a retailer that anybody could use. So, you know, $25 to Amazon is a very American context, but like that there's other ways of looking at that. And it really, really depends on the context and where you're recruiting from. But I would say with somebody who's not a user, you definitely need to state that up front. And also with someone who has canceled, because you need more, you really need to convince them into it. And that shows that you value their time. But for somebody who's an existing user, I don't suggest using gift cards. And that's really where company branded swag, or I mean, for everybody should get a thank you note, but really where the thank you note, and that, because it's more of a relationship rather than something transactional, which is a little bit what feels more like with non-users.
What are the biggest mistakes that product people make when recruiting people and conducting interviews, I guess, overall?
So something I learned when I was a product manager was that a big problem we had was no-shows. You schedule something with someone, you've gotten all this time, maybe you've got other stakeholders in the room listening with you, and then the person doesn't show up. And I mean, we would have like, maybe 20% of the people didn't show up. And we had a member of our team who was focused on recruiting people and was following up with them, and we still had that no-show rate. But something I have found and is corroborated in Lean Customer Development, Cindy Alvarez's great book on customer development for product people, is that including your title in the recruitment email really, really helps with no-shows. Even if it's a title that you have made up for the purpose of interviewing. And so if in your email, let's say your title is really product manager, but you put head of customer development because you're the person doing all the customer development, they are much more likely to reply to you and keep that meeting because you seem important. But if they just think they're blowing off the recruiting coordinator, then it's kind of like faceless, right? Like if they're blowing off a faceless person, it's easier to blow them off. But if they're like, oh, I have this call with the head of customer development at this company, like then it's a meeting, then it's something they have to show up for. And so I have found that once I started recruiting as co-founder of the company, or Cindy Alvarez talks about recruiting as the product manager, as you know, the head of product, as the whatever title she made up. She has a couple in her book that really helped with no-shows. I basically don't have a problem with no-shows anymore. Like I can't remember the last time I had a call and somebody just didn't show up and then never even, and if they didn't, like, I think there was one time when somebody didn't show up, but then they replied after and said, oh, I had this emergency, versus when we were recruiting with sort of anonymously, so to speak, we had a lot more issues with people not showing up, and then we would follow up with them and then they wouldn't reply.
Would you include that in the calendar like event title, or would you include that in the email invite?
No, so that would be in the initial recruitment email, and then just simply even just like I think my emails right now say something to the effect of, hi, you know, I am co-founder of GeoCodio, and I noticed you recently started using our product. I would love to find a time to understand what it is that leads you to even need geocoding in the first place. Listening to our customers is a core part of how we make decisions as a company, and your feedback will directly influence our roadmap. Here's how you can grab time on my calendar, or simply reply to this email if that works better. And then it says, Michelle Hansen, co-founder, GeoCodio. If I was a product manager, it would simply say, you know, I'm the product manager of the company, like, and have that in your title. You don't have to be the founder. You could still be the recruiting coordinator doing it, but say, you know, have your title. Have, you know, when you have a title, you seem more important. You're not just a faceless recruiting agency. You know, because then if people don't show up, they're disappointing a person, not an email.
That's a great tip. What's the best interview length? Because it feels that 30 minutes is kind of respectful of their time, but it's also not very much enough. And like 1 hour is definitely enough, but definitely not respectful of their time. What is the balance there?
So I think some of my best interviews have been around that 45 minute to an hour mark. And I think respectful really comes down to what does the other person have time for? You know, if the person only has time for half an hour, then ask your most important questions, you know, or maybe find one area just to focus on. You can't have them, you know, walk you through your whole website and how they use the whole thing, but maybe you can focus on just one feature, or maybe you can just focus on what they used before they used your product and why they switched. So that's a really important moment, rather than filling out the whole forces diagram or understanding the whole process that they're going on. So I think you can get really good information in half an hour. But I agree with you, 45 minutes to an hour can lead to richer information, but I just scale back my interviews as appropriate. You know, so every interview halfway through, I plan that I will be done with whatever my questions are. And then I ask them what I call the reaching for the door question, which is when the interview really opens up. And I find that that's when I get the good, meaty information. This comes from the medical field. Steve Portigal also talks about it in interviewing users, where that, you know, someone will go to the doctor and they're having their checkup, you know, everything seems fine and whatever. And then, you know, the doctor is reaching for the door and the patient is like, oh, by the way, my entire body is covered in bubbles. Like, should I be worried about that? You know, it's like at the very end, the real information comes out, right? And so if it's a half hour interview, you know, at the 20, 30 minute mark, I will say, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. I've learned so much from you. Is there anything else you want me to know? And then I just
wait.
In the most harmless voice you can possibly muster. And then the floodgates open. And I learned this really early on because we would schedule an hour interview and ask, you know, a form of that question of, you know, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. Really appreciate it. Is there anything else you want to add? And that would take more than the 10 minutes I had allotted. We would go way over. And that's when I felt like I wasn't respecting their time because I had told them it was going to be an hour. And here we are at an hour and 20 minutes and they're still talking. So I always ask that halfway through because, yeah, I find that that's, you know, you've built the trust at that point. You've primed them to think about the topic. They trust that you care what they're going to say. You're not going to interrupt them. You're going to let their experience speak and be heard. And so you've built the relationship in the first half of the interview. And then it's that second half where the magic happens. But I find that that can happen, you know, if you've done a good job building rapport in 15 minutes, which you can do, you can have great interview insights come out of it in a half an hour time frame. I've even had really good ones that were only 10 or 15 minutes because the person just suddenly didn't have time. But you got one nugget of information that was really helpful.
I guess the most common interview types, we kind of know what we should be asking about. So the new custom interview, you want to learn why they switched, the cancellation, why they canceled. When you interview them about a specific feature, we should ask you about like how we should do that. But there is certain type of call. For example, you have customer success manager available and you have a list of accounts who could do better. How do you even get them on the call? And what do you talk to them about? Like, hello, how can we improve the success of your account? That is kind of blunt. What is the best angle there?
Yeah, I call those happy customer interviews. Like these are okay. People who they're, you know, so talking to someone who has just, you know, bought the product, you know, a month ago, they're such a good person to understand really that switch process and okay, like what were they trying to solve? What caused that switch? You know, what were they trying to do? What helped them overcome the inertia of switching products? Like all of that. So good. But if you get to 6 months or a year or 2 years out when someone's using a product, that memory is not going to be as fresh. And so what do you talk to them about? I love using those interviews first to build a relationship between you and that customer so that they know that you are a company that actually cares about them and what they're trying to do, because most of us are used to working with faceless corporations that, I mean, you can't even find a customer support number for, never mind if you did, they wouldn't actually care to improve things for you. So showing that you're a company that actually cares about their customers alone, regardless of what you end up asking them or do with the information, is so valuable. Second of all, understanding their whole process. This is a great time to really dive into the whole job to be done. What is the big picture of what they're trying to do? Why are they trying to do it? What are all of the steps in that process? What are the functional, social, emotional pieces of that? What are they doing before they work with your product? What are they doing after? How do they feel about those things? You know, what are these adjacent steps that might be new opportunities for your business to make their life easier? That could be ideas for further interviews you do to see, do other people have these similar steps? What do the competitors look like in those spaces? Is this a good opportunity for our company? I get incredible ideas from those happy customer interviews. You can't just walk in there and say, hey, how can you charge us more, right? But you can find all of these other ways to figure out how your company could be providing more value to someone and building that relationship.
There is a certain angle to that that we face at UserList, and that is a lot of our customers are not using the full tool's potential. So there can be more things they could be doing, more things that they could be sending, but that means work for them. So how do you encourage that? Because it actually means that they have to invest effort, not just talk to us.
Mm-hmm. So that sounds like a twofold problem. The first angle of that, there's actually several here. So there's a discoverability problem, right? Like using a usability language, like, do they know that they can do those things? Where would they do them? Like there's sort of that, like there's a kind of a discoverability problem there, and maybe being aware of like certain affordances for doing things. So there's like one angle of like screen sharing with them and trying to, you know, someone you're like, okay, I think this customer could be doing more of this. They probably don't aware of it. Let me reach out to them. Sometimes when you do usability, it's helpful to do a gift card because it, like, for some reason, it feels more like work for them than a conversation does. So even saying, hey, like, we'll give you a $25 gift card and a hat or whatever, you know, whatever swag you have. Most people usually deny the gift card afterwards, but like, it's still, it's like the symbolism of it is important, if that makes sense. And exposing it to them that way, but also helping you understand, okay, why is it they haven't come across this? Why haven't they used it? Understanding how, what they perceive as the work to go into it. There's also another problem where we're kind of, we've touched on the forces diagram a little bit. There's inertia, there's habits, there's anxieties, there's pushes, there's pulls. Like, how do you understand, you know, diving into an interview and understanding, okay, they use it this way. They're already doing this with another product. Maybe we think like, so what are the habits that are driving them towards that other product? What are they, what are the anxieties they feel about switching to something new? And how then, how can we make it easier for them to switch? Which is sort of a key product problem that we try to solve is how, you know, how do we make that more seamless for them? How do we not, it, maybe they think it's a lot of work, but actually we've done a lot of work to make it not a lot of work. Or maybe there's things that we can do to make importing your data easier or setting it up. Like, can we have compatibility with other services? Like, so getting them on the phone, whether talking to them or also screen sharing with people can be really, really helpful for helping users understand the breadth of the product, but also understanding how you can make the breadth of the product easier and more approachable for people.
Yeah, definitely. Because there are tools like, you know, UseList is one example, but there is, I don't know, Photoshop. When
where do you start?
You know, you had it handed over to people, and then what? Like, you can build anything, and that is kind of a challenge. I'm sure Photoshop people and Creative Suite people are struggling with ideas how to inspire. But yeah, it's pretty. unlimited opportunity. Is there another use case or interview type that I'm missing out on that everybody should be doing, and but that is often overlooked?
Oh, that's interesting. So in terms of, you know, types of interviews, I guess the two, well, there's sort of some main categories, and I don't talk about all of them in my book. With my book, I was really trying to focus on the tactics and tools that are not covered approachably in other books. So for example, I don't talk too much about usability. I do mention sort of doing screen share interviews is what I call them, but I didn't want to call it usability because usability brings in a lot with accessibility. And I didn't focus on accessibility because there's so many good books and resources on that, that I didn't want to sort of repeat what has been already covered quite successfully. But sort of, you know, you have usability interviews, you have, you know, sort of phone call interviews, which can take a variety of forms, whether that's doing a jobs to be done switch interview, understanding what someone might be trying to do. They're not, you know, they haven't switched to something, why they've canceled, like all those different types of things, taking a voice interview, so to speak. And then also doing, you know, in-person interviews as well, which is something I also don't cover in the book because when I was writing the book, I was writing for sort of small teams in mind because a lot of the books out there on user interviewing are written for bigger resourced companies. And when I was recommending books to people and they would come across in a book, it says, oh, you know, and then you fly out to meet with the customer and observe them in their office. Somebody who is self-funding a company, like, does not have the money to buy plane tickets to go sit down for a day with somebody, right? Like, that's like, or hire, you know, consultants, right? Like, to do the interviews for them. So I didn't really talk about that very much, but there, you know, there's diary studies. Like, I mean, we could go on forever about all of the different ways to do user research. I will say that some amount of user research is better than none. So if you are doing no user research right now, don't bog yourself down with trying to figure out, should we be doing usability? Should we be doing diary studies? Should we be doing jobs to be done interviews? Like, start somewhere. And ideally start with the people who have been your happy customers for a long time, because they will be so excited to talk to you. Like, there's some advice out there that you should only talk to people who have recently purchased or recently canceled. And I disagree with that, because cancellation interviews are interviews on hard mode. Like, those are, that's expert level, because people are often upset about something because they hoped the product would solve a problem for them and then it didn't. They might be upset about how the cancellation process went. Like, maybe they meant to cancel sooner and then they forgot it and then they saw it on their credit card. Like, there's a lot of negative emotion going on there. Leave those for when you're comfortable with interviews. Start with the people who are happy. They will give you so much information and so much encouragement and make you feel really good about your product and give you such a great place to go from.
when you are in this feature focused mode, when you set your eye on a specific feature and you're having conversations with people who have requested it, this is hard for us as product owners because we've learned enough to not give specific roadmap promises because things change all the time. So like you have direct influence over our roadmap is, to be honest, an exaggeration because there is also a number of other customers and there is limited resources and stuff. So when you're in this mode of talking to somebody about a potential feature to be built, there is so much speculation involved because, you know, they ask for faster horses, we can offer them cars and all that. What is your advice on having these types of conversations?
Yeah, you know, when people request a specific feature, this actually happens all the time. People will email us, request a feature, and I'll say, you know, thank you so much for the suggestion. I'm saving this conversation and I will reach out if when we prioritize that. Can you just give me some background on what leads you to ask for that in the first place? And maybe they email me back, maybe we set up a call. But there's always the sense that I want to dig deeper into why they have asked for this because they have a problem and they have conceptualized it and expressed it as a solution, right? They have asked for a specific feature. And so then it is, I feel like, our job as the product people to pull back those layers and see, okay, they're expressing this problem as a solution. How do I figure out what that underlying problem is? Even if it seems incredibly obvious and I think I know the answer to it already, let me double check and dig in. And 9 times out of 10, I find that something that seems like a completely obvious feature request and I know why they're asking for it, the reason why they're asking for it is not the reason why I had predicted at all. And I learned so much from them just simply by asking them something that seems like an obvious question.
As we're wrapping up this call, can you sell our listeners on why it's better to invest more into working with your customers? Because everybody is so focused on marketing and sales. That's how you grow your revenue. But it's actually easier to unlock revenue with existing users. I'm not speaking like upselling them, but just generally turning them into fans, learning from them and stuff. Your final word of encouragement.
Understanding your customers better will supercharge those efforts that you're already doing. Sales and marketing, that's where I get all of my ideas from. So many of our new features come from a customer saying something offhand, and then I ask, wait a minute, can you say more about that? And then it turns out there's this whole other world there that I didn't even realize, often with things that our product already does, and then we simply need to talk about them more or talk about them in a different way. Describing things in the words of your users is so incredibly powerful because it shows that you understand them. And more than that, so brain imaging studies show that when we talk to somebody else about our experience, it lights up parts of the brain associated with joy and pleasure. And we associate those feelings with the person we're talking to. So merely the act of interviewing your customers will cause them to have these positive emotions associated with you and with your company, which turns them into huge supporters of you. For years, I have found that the customers that I interview are the ones who become our most avid supporters. They're the ones who are tweeting about us. They're the ones talking about us at conferences. They're the ones who are referring their friends and their coworkers to us because they know that we actually care about them. And that is so rare, I think, in this world to genuinely receive empathy from someone, to genuinely feel listened to. And even if it's about some boring business problem, like sending invoices, you don't have to dive into their whole life, but just understanding something that they're going through every day or every week is going to be so valuable to them. And it will be so valuable to your company because you will understand how to do the things you're already doing with more impact. And interviews, yes, they maybe cost you a half an hour or an hour of your time. That's a lot cheaper than spending months building a feature that no one uses or thousands of dollars on ads that don't land because they're not conceptualizing the problem in the way that users really feel it.
What are some good ways? You mentioned that sometimes you would have a feature already built, but there's another use case or specific inspirational thing that you want to share, and you only have like one channel or two channels, you can send, you know, in-app notification, you can send an email to them. But on the other hand, you have this trust with them and you don't want to abuse this channel. Any tips on telling your customers more about your product capabilities? It's a bit off interviews, but kind of.
Yeah, this is such a good question. It's actually like something I've been thinking about lately because, you know, we do have customers who want to be on a, you know, a product updates email or even ask us how they get on our product updates email. But also, I mean, quite frankly, I find that I unsubscribe from all of the newsletters that I'm on. I get way too much.
I'm ruthless too. Absolutely. Yeah, I'm almost killing everything.
I almost kind of enjoy clicking unsubscribe on things. Like, feels like Marie Kondoing my inbox, you know? And, you know, there's in-app notifications. There's conversations with people. I got to say, I don't know. I mean, it's a combination of things, right? It's how do you make it discoverable to them within their existing workflow? I think whenever we can make our products more contextual. So, you know, rather than having an onboarding video or tour that they have to go through, making it contextual with the process they're already trying to do to get something done, like work, you know, weaving it into what they're already doing. You know, we've had good success actually with putting announcements on transactional email. So for example, when somebody uploads a spreadsheet. So for example, somebody geocodes a spreadsheet, adding a message at the bottom of that. Actually, when I was a product manager, transactional email had our highest open rates of any email. We had some daily transactional emails that went out to users based on, for lack of a better way of putting it, I'll say like topics they were following. And those emails had the highest open and click rates of all of our emails. And so we started putting new feature announcements in there and sales and offers and all that kind of stuff. And those started getting traffic because people were opening those emails every day because they were useful to them. And so actually we've been thinking about like, oh, like, you know, what if we were sending out, you know, for example, for our pay-as-you-go product, people have wanted a weekly billing alert to just tell them what their balance was and what their activity was. Like, we could put new feature announcements in there, but like making it contextual, because some people like newsletters and some people don't mind in-app notifications, but they're kind of obtrusive in a way and they're existing outside of the product experience because, well, I guess an in-app notification exists within it, but like an email, like they're doing a bunch of other things. They're not thinking about your product. And then you're there and it's like, okay, like context switch. But if they get a transactional email from you that says, oh, here's this spreadsheet that I wanted to download to get on with my work. And oh, wait, by the way, hold on. There's this thing about this other feature they have. Okay, that's kind of interesting. Maybe they're not going to click it, but they'll come back to it later when they're like, when they realize it, that they might need something like that because it's there and they know where to find it. And that's an email that they probably didn't delete because they needed it for something. I'm still trying to figure this out myself, but I feel like transactional email is a massive under-tapped resource for software companies. And I think we could be doing so much more with transactional email. I even noticed that, like, you know, I was updating some settings on Google recently and the confirmation transactional email I got was like basically plain text. And I was like, Google, like you could, like you have the resources to be doing more with this. Yeah, if I had to invest my money anywhere, if there was a stock, so to speak, I would put my money on transactional email.
It's interesting that ADPNR started Receiptful, or mm-hmm. so it was called, and then it was turned into a full-fledged ESP and was then sold as Convergio. So he definitely tapped into that potential, but then it went elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, definitely hidden opportunity. And we're actually looking to bring transactional email into user list as well so that we can leverage this easier. I imagine there could be, for example, a snippet, and we have snippets as variables, like you can have a snippet with a monthly tip or like new feature announcement or something.
Yeah, make it dynamic, basically. I think that's the challenge we have with transactional email is that it's like hard-coded, basically. And so it's to update the transactional email and use them as a channel is like, it's usually a lot of work. So yeah, if you could make that like a dynamic variable within transactional email, that would be awesome.
There is one famous tip for email marketing is to use a dynamic snippet inside of your evergreen newsletter so that you can have, you know, planned content. And then in the PS, you can promote something fresh. But that is whole new level. It's exciting. There is also another method, and we see this when we log in to mature ESPs like, you know, MailChimp or Drip. When they have tips and tools and tricks and templates all over, like on the sidebars and the sidelines.
I just want to send my freaking email. Get out of my way.
It's kind of, you know, banner blindness and like, please leave me alone there.
Yes, so. Exactly.
It's hard.
Yeah.
Well, that's been a great addition and the, you know, door handle phase of our call today.
Yeah.
If our listeners want to learn more, read your book, where can they find it?
Yeah, so you can find more about my book at deployempathy.com. You can actually download the whole first part of the book. It's about like 30 or 50 pages. You can see the newsletter where I wrote all the first drafts. You can also buy a copy from Amazon or your local bookstore or online as well. There's my SaaS, Geocodio, geocod.io. And then my podcast, Software Social, is at softwaresocial.dev, and it comes out every Tuesday.
And I think you're on Twitter pretty actively, right?
Oh, yes. I'm also on Twitter at MJW Hansen.
One last question. You referred to several books along this episode. I just want to recap them for our listeners so that they can find them as well alongside your book. One is by Steve Portigal. What's the title?
I believe that one is just called Interviewing Users. Uh-huh. Fantastic book for like in-person interviews, especially. Really good. Really good, like expert level book.
And Cindy Alvarez?
Yes, Cindy Alvarez's Lean Customer Development, which is written from the perspective of a product manager. I believe she was a product manager at Yammer and later at Microsoft, which was acquired by Microsoft. So great book. She also has a lot of good tips on selling the idea of customer development to your leadership in that book.
Amazing. Well, this was a goldmine of advice on customer development. Thanks so much for joining us today and sharing it.
Thank you so much for having me.
And have a wonderful rest of your week, Michelle.
You too.